Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking about three titles that came out last Wednesday, September the 5th. Then I'm also going to talk about the second issue of the Charles Soule run of Daredevil. I had talked about wanting to get caught up on Daredevil, and I honestly didn't even remember where I left off, so I warned you guys I would be talking about Daredevil for quite a while on Marvel Mondays, probably one issue, maybe a few if I read an issue and I just can't wait till the next week to cover the next. I may do several. So anyway, the first book I'm going to talk about is Death of the Inhumans. Give the creative team really fast. It's written by Donnie Cates. We've got art by Ariel Olivetti. Colors by the incomparable Jordi Belair. Letters by Clayton Cowles. So, the speculation, and from what I've read, it seems to be borne out, is that this Death of the Inhumans event is a way for Donnie Cates to sort of clean up the Inhumans corner of the Marvel Universe. The fact of the matter is there wasn't an Inhumans corner of the Marvel Universe for many, many years, and then I think it has to do with film rights, honestly, but I've talked about it to death on the podcast in the past, so I'm not going to get into detail here, but Marvel was basically shoving the Inhumans down our throats for quite a few years. Nobody seemed to want it, and they seemed to have gone away and be focused on the X-Men, again, the X-Men corner of the universe. And so I don't know if Donnie Cates approached Marvel with this idea, or if Marvel asked him if he had an idea, what would he do if he basically was writing a series called Death of the Inhumans, but it's been a bloodbath so far. Issue 2 ended on a cliffhanger where we saw Black Bolt get his throat slit, which is pretty interesting considering that he has his powers are based on his voice. And he's actually one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe. He can just about split a planet in half with the sound of his voice. So you can imagine that having his throat cut, not a good thing for Black Bolt. So I really like this issue a lot, and I'll talk more about what I thought about it after I go over what happens. It opens up with Medusa sitting, waiting in silence, and she's literally pulling her hair out. She's so worried. It's been far too long since she's heard from her husband. And based on the war with the Kree, she's very, very worried. And as I said, literally pulling her hair out. So she finally gets news from Crystal and Gorgon. And Crystal walks in and says, "We found him." Medusa asks where he was. Gorgon says, "In a stolen Kree ship, barely alive, bleeding and nearly frozen to death." And Medusa says, "Frozen? I don't understand." Gorgon's response is, "He had run out of fuel and was thus using the ship's life support and atmosphere to get an extra boost out of the engine." So basically turning the life support all the way down to keep the ship going. And Medusa's like, "Well, if anyone could survive being chased across the stars by the Kree," and Gorgon says, "No, Chase? No, he was doing the chasing." And it's Karnak they're referring to, not Black Bolt. So as we turn the page, we see Karnak, pulling off all these sensors from the med bay he was in. And Medusa is trying to ask how he is, and Karnak doesn't want to talk about that. He just wants to talk about Black Bolt. Karnak says, "They have him. They slit his throat, took him from us." And Crystal wants to go to Earth, wants to tell the Avengers and the other heroes. She wants to ask for help. And Medusa's response is, "No, they have my husband, and this is no place for heroes, not with what comes next." Meanwhile, on the Kree ship, Black Bolt is getting his throat sewn up, stitched up. And Vox asks the Kree general, "Do you hear it, General?" And the general says, "Hear what, Vox?" And Vox's response is, "Exactly. There's nothing. There's nothing to hear because Black Bolt has had his throat slit." And Vox says, "Black Bolt's great power is gone. He is no longer a threat. The prophecy is dead. The Midnight King is silent. Long live the Kree Empire. And the general's response is, how can you be so sure? And Vok says, look at him. We have destroyed his kingdom, killed his people, brought him to his knees, and now we stitch him back together with no sedatives and no anesthesia to dull the pain. If he could still scream, he would. And you know what I thought when I read that line? I was like, you know, Vox, you are definitely underestimating Black Bolt, because despite him maybe not being that popular or that well-known, Black Bolt is one of the badasses of the Marvel Universe. So the next scene, we see a couple of Kree soldiers standing guard over Black Bolt as he kneels in his cell. And they're giving Black Bolt a tough time, saying, hey, Boltagon, sing us a song. And it seems like Black Bolt's arrested long enough. And he starts to open his mouth, and one of the guards says, wait, can he? And Black Bolt says, lockjaw. What? What was that? My lord, we can't quite hear you. And Black Bolt continues, Maximus. And he's not speaking very loudly at all. But we saw in the past that Black Bolt, with a whisper, could kill. Then one of the other guards said, this is pathetic, that's enough, we're not supposed to kill you, but if you don't, and Black Bolt continues, naming another of the dead Inhumans, Triton. And one of the guards is bleeding from his nose, saying, I don't feel so, and when he realizes he's bleeding, Black Bolt's continuing, listing the dead, Flagman. The other guard hits Black Bolt with the butt of his rifle. The first has taken off his helmet. He's starting to lose it. Black Bolt continues. Sterilon. Glass Girl. Nausea. And at this point, the guards are both bleeding profusely. And the final words that Black Bolt utters are, New Arctolan. And that's it. Both guards have perished. Black Bolt still has enough power in his voice to basically explode the cell wall. He comes out of his cell. He's holding one of the guns. And we get the narration. So it began there in the silent halls of a decaying world. The prophecy of the Midnight King began to bloom in Black Bolt's broken throat. Well, I love that idea that this prophecy of this Midnight King that was going to basically bring the Kree Empire to ruin, and Vox and the leaders of this new ruling regime of the Kree Empire believed it to be Black Bolt. And so for that reason, they wanted to kill him and render him powerless. And in doing so, they actually have fulfilled the prophecy. At least that's the way it looks. So as Black Bolt moves through the ship, the narration goes on to say that his voice was once an atomic bomb. It's now been reduced to little else but a prison knife. But Blackagar knew he had one great bellow left in his chest before his instrument shattered for good. But in the meantime, he's using his voice like a scalpel. Like he's never really used it before. So it's interesting. And the other thing it's allowing for the first time is Black Bolt to communicate to some extent, because in the past, he couldn't communicate with his voice. Everything was sign language or written, because the barest whisper would unleash destruction. So we see now that his power has been reduced in scope. He's still deadly, but it does allow him some semblance of communication. And again, this panel, I love the narration. And so it was here that Black Bolt began to write the song he would sing to bring the Kree to ruin. So as Black Bolt moves throughout the ship, he doesn't just use his voice. He uses the Kree's own weapons against them. Planning and thinking. Because this is really his aria, delivered on a whisper and building into a hurricane. It would be the last thing the Kree would ever hear. And Black Bolt knew they would be the last words he would ever speak. So again, he has some limited power now, and he knows he has one last blast within him but he also knows it'll probably break his vocal cords for good, and that'll be the end of his power. Meanwhile, the rest of the Inhuman royal family are traveling somewhere, and Gorgon's asking if she's sure about this. They haven't spoken to this man in a long time. Last he heard, he's working for mercenaries, and by all accounts, he seemed quite content to be left alone. But Medusa says, you know, we need allies, specifically powerful allies with flexible allegiances who aren't afraid of war. Now the time for planning's over. What we need now is someone who can hit things very hard. And Crystal says, yeah, he did love Lockjaw. They were always going on adventures together when they thought no one was watching. When he hears about this, Karnak says he'll tear a hole in the fabric of space and time to wrap his hands around the throat of the Kree. Which I'm assuming is precisely why we're going to this godforsaken rock to enlist him in the first place. Medusa says, I hear your tone, and I don't like leveraging the deaths of our family any more than you do, Karnak. And Karnak's like, no, on the contrary, I love it. The tone you heard was admiration. So by all means, let's go get this guy. So meanwhile, on the Kree ship, Black Bolt is continuing to destroy the Kree at every turn, and eventually he comes across Ronan the Accuser. And again, it's interesting that Black Bolt is able to speak. And he even says, Ronan. And Ronan says, hey, it's good to hear your voice. And Black Bolt wants to know what happened. And Ronan explains that he was on Hala when this new ruling council landed. They came home, they'd gone mad, heretics, and they desecrated the Supreme Intelligence. They said the old ways of the Kree are dead, and then they accused him. Ronan the Accuser was accused and found unfit. And so they changed him, like they changed all of you, made him into something. He's hooked up to all these machines. He's got all these hoses coming out of him. And Ronan says, yeah, it's what they do. It's their mission. Take the useful, kill the useless. They're bringing all of their children home one way or the other. But you, Blackagar, they have to break you. And don't let them turn me into them, please. And then he actually apologizes. He says, Black Bolt, I'm sorry. I regret all the times I hurt your family. I'm sorry. And Black Bolt whispers, you are forgiven, this time using his power. So again, it seems like the power is still there, very much weakened. But he was able to speak to Ronan without doing damage until he chose to do so. Meanwhile, on the planet Marcus Centuria, Crystal, Gorgon, Karnak, and Medusa have landed. And they go and talk to a bean in a hut who says, I don't work for no house. I swear no allegiances. I'm quite drunk. You're not welcome here. Leave while you can. Crystal says, wait, this isn't about houses or allegiances. The Kree killed our home. They're killing people. They've killed Maximus and Triton and Lockjaw, and they've taken Black Bolt. And we see a voice say, hold. What the hell did you say about Lockjaw? As the curtain is moved aside from the hut, and there stands Beta Ray Bill. So then we get the text. Next, the Wrath of Beta Ray Bill. I had no idea who it was. I know Lockjaw had his own series for a little while. Didn't know who he teamed up with there. But the fact that it's Beta Ray Bill, I mean, of all characters, Beta Ray Bill. Beta Ray Bill and Lockjaw had adventures. I love it. I love the fact that it's going to be Beta Ray Bill unleashed, as it were. He's not going to be holding back. He seems to have kind of fallen off the reservation there, fallen off the grid. And, you know, he's quite the hero. He was quite noble at one point. And the fact that he's working as a mercenary now, clearly something's happened to him. He doesn't seem to care. You know, Crystal's listing off the dead, you know, Maximus and Triton and Black Bolt captured. No, all Beta Ray Bill cares about is the fact that Lockjaw's dead. So I imagine he's going to go a little berserker on the Kree and it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. The other thing I really liked about the issue was, as I mentioned throughout, Black Bolt having the ability to communicate by his voice now. His power is greatly reduced. He has one last big blow, one last big blast with his voice left in him, he feels, before it's broken for good. I don't know. It's interesting. I've always liked Black Bolt as a character. First of all, his name's Blackagar Boltagon, and that's just a really cool name. So it gets shortened to Black for Blackagar and Bolt for Boltagon. You get Black Bolt. Really cool name. And I've always liked the way he's looked. I like the fact that he was so very powerful, but he had to live under constant restraint. Constant restraint. Not speaking, because it could do just so much damage. And it meant that when he did speak words, they obviously had to be extremely important. Here we see Kate's kind of turn that around, and he has a little more control over his power. He's not as powerful, but he's wielding it like a scalpel, and he's able to aim it. And I just like that for a while. I like it for a while because it's new and it's different. But I would like to see a return. I would like to see Black Bolt healed and return to, I don't want to say status quo, but I want him to be the Black Bolt that I knew that could, you know, basically pulverize the moon with the sound of his voice. Cause it's just, I just like that. It's such a great power and such an amazing drawback. But the fact that he can speak now to people, it is interesting and cool. And I think you can do a lot of great things with that because it's new for Black Bolt, wielding that voice as a small prison knife. It's a good visual. It's a good way to think about it. So, really excited. I've been really digging this Death of Inhumans series right from the first, despite the high body count. And what's interesting is, you know, I mentioned how Marvel was trying to shove the Inhumans down our throats for quite a few years, take the place of the X-Men if possible, since they still had the film rights to the Inhumans when they didn't have them for the X-Men. But it never worked. I never wanted to, despite the fact that it was written by Charles Soule, I read the first few issues only for that reason, and it was good, but I still dropped it because it was the Inhumans. I now want to go back and read all this Inhuman stuff that's come out for the last few years. The series has me hungry for more Inhuman stories. So that's interesting, right? Talk about ironic. The series that's going to kind of clean up and clean house with the Inhumans is what finally has me interested in reading about them, because they're telling a good story here, right? Marvel's probably not dictating much to Donnie King other than, hey, reduce the number of Inhumans. There's too many of them. But between Frank McGee, what Cates is doing here, finding myself wanting to read more about the Inhumans. So it just goes to show that you can try to shove something down a fan's throat, but if you want something to sell, all you have to do is tell a good story. Like, tell a good story. Don't just shove stuff down our throats. Don't just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. Concentrate on story and quality first, and the desire for the fans to read it will come of its own accord. So, incredible issue. The art by Ariel Olivetti and the work by Belair and Cowles. It's all top notch. I mean, this book is really, really good. I would definitely recommend everybody jump on this Death of Inhumans, especially because it's likely that the events of this book are going to have lasting repercussions for the Inhumans and the Marvel Universe as a whole going forward. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about, speaking of lasting repercussions, it's Thanos Legacy, also written by Donnie Cates, which seems to be just about every Marvel book these days. It's got art by Brian Lovell, colors by Jordan Boyd, and letters by that Clayton Cowles guy again. So I'm not caught up with Thanos. I was reading the Jeff Lemire run. I fell off of it. I know that Donnie Cates took over at some point. I know the Cosmic Ghost Rider showed up. I know that from reading Infinity Wars that Gamora killed Thanos, cut his head off. But I didn't read the Thanos run, and I'm a little behind on what's going on. I need to get caught up with it. So this Thanos Legacy title is supposed to kind of fill in the gaps between what happened after Thanos was killed and the beginning of the Infinity War. So we do see in this issue, there's a little bit of a recap. Talks about Thanos traveling to the future, meeting his future self, and then wanting to change his destiny. And it then goes on to show him trying to find a way to change that destiny, and basically deciding that the way he was going to do it is to just let nature run its course. And nature runs its course by Gamora showing up, killing him, and cutting off his head. And so that's all told in this real interesting narration of almost like flashback, right? Again, I'm not completely clear on exactly what's going on because I'm behind on my Thanos for sure. But after his head is cut off, Cosmic Ghost Rider Frank Castle does show up, and he literally pisses fire onto Thanos' body and sets it alight, and then says, "He's all yours, boys." And we see these demon-type dog creatures literally eating Thanos' corpse. And as one of them is biting into Thanos, there's a ping and an explosion with parts of Thanos raining down on Cosmic Ghost Rider. He's saying, "What the bleep?" And then we see a figure show up saying, "Careful, Rider, his body is booby-trapped." And Rider says, "Yeah, and how the bleep would you know that?" And we get the response of, "Because he's my brother," and it's actually Star Fox. So he has Ghost Rider move aside, and Star Fox goes to work on the body, looking for something that could possibly start a war. And before it gets set off and begins an endgame that will burn the universe to the ground, Star Fox wants to get his hands on it himself, and Cosmic Ghost Rider says, "Wait, what could be inside the old dead piece of crap body that could ignite a war?" And Star Fox has finished cutting it out, and he says, "His will." And he's holding this round ring, I guess, this round object. Looks to be maybe some kind of a computer disc or technology that supposedly holds, I'm assuming it means Thanos's will, as in like last will and testament, rather than his willpower. So curious to see where that goes next. There's also a backup in this Thanos Legacy number one issue. It's written by Jerry Dugan with art by Corey Smith, colors by Ruth Redmond. There is no letterer because there are no words. And it's a Thanos Gamora story, with Thanos basically teaching Gamora how to be his daughter, I'll say, how to kill, how to be ruthless. We see her head down to the planet, and we see her get cold feet a few times when she possibly has the chance to make a difference and hurt people who look like they deserve it. But she chickens out. She does fulfill her father's mission in a way, but it's in about the weakest way possible. She basically finds a guy who's already knocked out, may already be dead, and cuts his head off. When she shows Thanos, he clearly is not pleased. Perhaps he was watching and saw her failure and saw the way she supposedly completed her mission. But then Thanos shows that the whole planet is going to pay the price for Gamora's mercy and lack of a killer instinct. And he presses a button on his ship and literally blows the planet to pieces to Gamora's terror. As she's looking out the spaceship window, she sees the planet starting to explode from the inside out. So I imagine we'll get more of those backups going forward in the Thanos Legacy series. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is Immortal Hulk number 5. When last we left Immortal Hulk, Bruce Banner had met Jackie McGee, a nod to the 70s Bill Bixby TV show, and Banner had showed up at the hospital where Walter Longowski was having surgery, and then transformed into Sasquatch and was attacking the doctors in the operating room. So this issue starts out, and it says it's set before on Alpha Flight Space Station, and we see Lankowski in his Sasquatch form, asking what's going on of Captain Marvel. Is this a performance view or an intervention? And Captain Marvel says, you know, we're just concerned, that's all. You do good work, and I know you have since long before I led the operation, but you're much more aggressive in the field, and you've got a history when it comes to losing control. And, you know, she's referring to the fact that Lankowski as Sasquatch was possessed by an otherworldly entity for a time. Tanarak is the name. And Sasquatch himself knows that that's what Captain Marvel's referring to, and responds, Carol, come on, Tanarak's long dead. I'm not possessed by anything. It's me in there. I would see Puck say, yeah, but there's a lot of in there lately, right? We've been up here a year, and every day I see a lot of Sasquatch, but I never see Walter Lankowski at all. Why is that? And so later we see Sasquatch in the locker room saying, you want Walter? I can, come on, I can be Walter. And then he remarks, okay, that was a lot tougher than it used to be. I probably should talk to someone. And when he looks in the mirror, he doesn't see a reflection of Walter Lankowski. He sees a reflection of Sasquatch. So meanwhile, Bruce is telling Jackie McGee that he thinks the Hulk wants out, which probably isn't a good sign. Tells McGee to evacuate the hospital, and Bruce will deal with Lankowski or whatever he becomes. But McGee, she's like, yeah, I've got questions. You owe me answers. She doesn't want to follow along with Bruce's plans. And Bruce's response is, I owe a lot of people everything from stolen pants to ruined lives. Where you fall on that spectrum will have to wait. Because the important thing now is finding out what's going on with Lankowski. So McGee says, well, I can tell these people to run. But why? Because a man might have risen from the dead? Why would they believe me? Bruce says, you're a reporter. It's your job to make people believe you, but the screaming will probably help. So he says, I know you've got your job too, but let me try first. You never know. So we see over the loudspeaker that there's a code silver. All patients must be evacuated immediately. And as Bruce enters the operating room, we see that Sasquatch has basically killed everybody in there. And Bruce says, hello, Walter, can we talk? And the response is, I'm not Walter, and I'd rather talk to the real you. And he swipes right across Bruce's throat, and blood starts spurting everywhere. Sasquatch's response is, it hurts to die, doesn't it, Bruce? And Bruce sputters out, always. But then, of course, immediately turns into the Hulk, who says, when you hurt Banner, I take it personal. And Hulk immediately knows that this is not Walter Lankowski. He says that fits, because Lankowski's a creep, smug little know-it-all, but he never had 3 murders in him. You're something else, aren't you? And Sasquatch's response is, see, nobody ever loved Walt for his mind. They always wanted the jock, so he stayed furry, stayed that way for months. And basically what happened is something got in. He stayed as Sasquatch for too long, and it left a door open, and something got in. Bruce says, yeah, or the Hulk, rather, you know, got into that green door. So you got into Hotshot's girlfriend too, which we saw a few issues back. You wanted my attention. Why is that? Who are you? Are you Tanarak? Are you Mephisto? Something worse? Who's in there? And Sasquatch responds, well, see for yourself, little monster. Look behind you. And the Hulk looks behind, in the reflection on the glass, and it's actually his father. And Sasquatch says, little monster. And the Hulk says, daddy? because that's exactly what his father used to call him. And so the Hulk is almost living through flashback of Bruce's memories, seeing how he was abused and traumatized by his father. And it's distracting for the Hulk. He starts actually losing the fight as Sasquatch speaks as if he were Bruce's father, saying, I wish I'd killed you in the crib. So meanwhile, the evacuation of the hospital continues, but it's complicated by the fact that there are people there that are on life support that can't be moved. So they're doing the best that they can, but it's not going well. So Jackie McGee says, I've got to do something. So does one of the cops. He says, just keep everyone calm. I'm going to see what I can do. And they both head in to the operating room. Meanwhile, Hulk is saying, it's not you. It can't be. And Sasquatch responds, well, you can see ghosts and you can smell lies. You'd know if it weren't me. I'm the father you killed, Bruce, back through the green door, back from death. So the Hulk seems to be afraid, and he's being pushed by Sasquatch. I mean, who else can make the monster scared? And finally, the Hulk snaps. He says, no, never. You're just a man, a twisted old man. You killed your wife. You tried to kill your son. You scare him. You scare Banner. But that doesn't give you power over me. I mean, it seemed to for a while, but then the Hulk, you know, reasserted himself. And he basically knocks out Sasquatch, puts a blow with all of his strength behind it, and says, you're nothing. Any power you have, someone gave you. Who are you? Who brought you back? Who opens the door? Tell me or I'll smash you. And the Wendigo, or the Sasquatch rather, is struggling to get up. And he says, you know, it needs a host personality to work or function in this world. It burrows in, wears our soul like masks on a stage. And again, Hulk says, who does? What does? Tell me, what's behind you? You know, what is this? And Sasquatch says, in every mirror there's a reflection. As above, so below. And my shadow is much darker than yours. So again, Sasquatch is insisting he's Bruce's father. He goes on to say that Gamma made Lankowski your equal, but he just doesn't know how to use it. But I know what needs to be done. I can smell the sick and the weak. And as he continues to fight with the Hulk, the security guard has arrived and tries to use a taser on him and basically gets his guts ripped out and then goes after the reporter, Jackie McGee. And that's when the Hulk realizes Gamma is what made Lankowski what he is, what it made you, and it's what keeps the green door open, doesn't it? But I eat Gamma, says the Hulk, and he literally pulls the Gamma radiation out of Sasquatch into himself, which turns Lankowski back into a human, and he's actually alive. So Hulk says, Gamma radiation, I absorb it, it makes me stronger. And I took all of his. No more Sasquatch. Ever. No more dad or whatever that was. And then the Hulk wants to know, you know, McGee, you're with a local paper and you drove across how many states to find me? And you couldn't even look at Banner. I noticed that you can't look right at me either. So whatever this is, it's personal and I want the truth now. And McGee doesn't necessarily want to answer. She's like, I still have this man's blood on me. Like, maybe because of me, but the Hulk's insistent. She says, okay, when I was 15, you destroyed my home, my whole neighborhood. And they said, we should never look you in the eye. But I did. I saw you that day and I have questions. And the Hulk's surprised. He's shocked. But he does agree to answer one question, but make it quick, he says. And McGee very surprisingly says, fine, here's my quick question. How do I do it? How? How do I get to be what you are? And again, that surprises the Hulk. And he tells McGee, just go home, McGee, go home. So I suppose McGee wants the power because she doesn't want to feel vulnerable. as she did when she was little. So the Hulk takes his leave, and Lankowski's regaining consciousness. He's asking Jackie what happened, and Jackie says, you don't remember? Sasquatch killed the man right in front of me. I didn't even know his name. And Lankowski says, he's gone. And McGee responds, yeah, the Hulk, he just left. Lankowski says, no, not the Hulk. Sasquatch, I could always feel him, and now I can't. He's gone. Where did he go? So as the Hulk moves through the parking lot, he glances at the car next to him, and in the reflection, he doesn't see himself. He doesn't see the Hulk. He sees Bruce's father. So the name of the story, In Every Mirror, written by Al Ewing, pencils by Joe Bennett, inks by Ryu Jose, colors by Paul Mounts, and letters by Corey Petit, continues to be one of the best titles that Marvel's writing. This was super unexpected. I didn't expect the big bad to be Bruce's father. It's always a good place to go with Bruce, I think, because despite all the stories that have been told about the abusiveness that both Bruce and his mother suffered at the hands of his father, I still feel like it's an issue that Bruce has. It's unsettled, despite all the different versions and the angst that it causes Bruce. It's always seemed unsettled to me. It's always something that writers can mess with and something they can go back to. And really, to my mind, this is what created the Hulk. It's not necessarily the gamma radiation. That was just the trigger. The abuse and kind of I guess you could say the trauma that Bruce suffered at the hands of his father is really what's responsible for the Hulk coming into being. So maybe that's why he was having a tough time when he first saw Bruce's father inside Lankowski. And is it really Bruce's father, or is it some kind of psychological manifestation? That's all to be explored more, I'm sure. So again, really, really great title. Really digging what Al Ewing and company are doing with the Immortal Hulk title. All right, the last issue I'm going to talk about is Daredevil, number 2. Starts out, we get a dual narration here, one by Ten Fingers, one by Matt Murdock. Ten Fingers is talking to his followers about how they've been neglected, but they now have the power to make themselves felt, and they are basically applying for legitimate church status, and that will ensure that their great shared work will last. Meanwhile, Matt Murdock is telling the others in the DA office about what a criminal Ten Fingers is and how they've got to stop Ten Fingers Church of the Sheltering Hands from achieving its goal of getting legitimate status from the Internal Revenue Service, because the old story that Ten Fingers is selling is salvation. He's targeting undocumented immigrants. People don't have a lot of options. He promises to keep them safe and keep them from being deported. And all they have to give him in return is everything they have, which, if you believe in something, is a pretty simple thing to do, right? So Ten Fingers continues to address his congregation, saying, we've all made many sacrifices. We've all worked hard, and we've just got to hang in there and focus on the great leap forward. And he says, I promise our church will survive the government's assaults on our belief. I've taken steps to make sure of that. And you'll see your faith in me is not misplaced. So meanwhile, Matt Murdock is talking about the fact that there's a grand jury about to convene, and they've got a great witness named Billy Lee. And it should only be a matter of time before Lee testifies and they get a chance to shut down the Church of Ten Fingers. So the way Ten Fingers plans to accomplish this is he sent a 3-man team. One of them included being Blindspot, although I don't think that Ten Fingers nor any of the henchmen that work for Ten Fingers realize that it is Blindspot. Samuel Chung, they think it's just another follower of 10 fingers. So they managed to sneak in to the courthouse and overpower the guards that are guarding Billy Lee. And they don't kill him, despite that being the order from 10 fingers. Kill Billy Lee and kill Daredevil. Because we're left wondering, okay, what's Blindspot doing working for 10 fingers? It doesn't seem that Daredevil is aware that Blindspot's working. So is Blindspot working for 10 fingers to betray 10 fingers from the inside out? Or does he actually believe the rhetoric and he's pulling the wool over Daredevil's eyes? That's what we're not sure of. But what we are sure of is, by the time Matt goes to check on Billy Lee, he says he's changed his mind. He's not going to testify. And he's had 2 fingers on each hand removed. So back at Chinatown, at the Church of the Sheltering Hands, 10 Fingers is thanking Samuel for bringing him more fingers. But he's disappointed that Billy Lee is still alive. And he says, but unless I'm mistaken, didn't I tell you to kill Billy Lee and the lawyer too? And the other henchman said, we told him 10 fingers, but he wouldn't do it. And Blindspot Samuel Chung says it wasn't the right time. Taking out Murdoch and Billy at the same day as a hearing would have been connected right back to you really quickly. So I didn't see that as a good plan. And it doesn't matter because there's not even going to be a trial now because we convinced Billy Lee not to testify. Ten Fingers says, I see the logic. I can even appreciate that you're trying to act with the best interest of the church in mind, but still an order is an order. And the 8 understand that. And that's why they've been granted a small piece of Ten Fingers' power. We see a few of them there, and this was actually a test for Samuel Chung, a test that he failed. You have the skills, no doubt, but it's the loyalty that still remains in question. And then we get this bombshell where Ten Fingers says, your mother asked me to give you the opportunity. She apparently is one of the right hand, or one of the 10 fingers, I guess you might say, of 10 fingers, right? And Ten Fingers goes on to say, I have no doubt your mother's as disappointed in you as I am. And Samuel Chung offers to do better next time. So nothing stands in the way now that Billy Lee is not going to testify. And soon the real work will begin. So Samuel is dismissed while Ten Fingers has a chance to speak to his senior advisors. Meanwhile, at the prearranged meeting place, Blindspot, and Daredevil are sparring. Daredevil is trying to teach Blindspot not to be too reliant on his powers, because for Blindspot's perspective, he's like, why do I need to know how to fight? I'm not going to have to fight because they're not going to be able to see me or know where to punch. And Daredevil's response is, hey, powers come and go. You don't want to rely on them too much. Develop all your skills to where anything can be a weapon, even words. And Blindspot says, it's not really fair. You can see me when I've got the suit running, but most people won't be able to see me. So, the way you're fighting me is not fair. Daredevil doesn't really seem to think that's the way to go. And he basically gets the drop on Blindspot and tears off the gadget that allows him to turn invisible. And Daredevil says, see, you need to be the weapon, not some gadget. And Blindspot says, I don't know, Iron Man seems to do okay. And I love this line. Daredevil says, you could drop Tony Stark naked in the middle of the desert and he'd fly out in a jet made of sand and cactus needles. It's not his stuff that gives him power, it's his brain. Try using yours, you'll be amazed at what makes a difference. And this takes Samuel Chung, Blindspot, by surprise. He's like, man, who killed your dog and ate it? And in reference to Stick, Daredevil says, don't complain. The guy who trained me would have killed your dog and then fed it to you. But he does mention that he had a bad day at work. And Samuel Chung says, you too? What kind of work do you do? And Daredevil says, I get rid of the bad guys. And Blindspot's not having it. He said, really? Because last time I checked, Ten Fingers is still sitting in that temple on Mott, eating away at my family. and you're eating away at my neighborhood, rather, and ripping apart my family. And, you know, we should stop waiting for this lawyer to handle it. We should just go there and stop him. That's what we need to do. So he's pretty passionate. He actually convinces Daredevil to go ahead and attack. Frontal assault, if you will. So as Daredevil dives off the building, follows Blindspot, we see in the temple that there are a couple of the henchmen of Ten Fingers that are being endowed with some of his power, basically the reward for being such good assistants, I suppose you would say, lieutenants. And he gives a little of his power to them, and Blindspot and Daredevil are watching from overhead, and Blindspot says, "What is he doing?" Daredevil says, "Oh no," and screams at Ten Fingers to stop, which surprises everybody that Daredevil would give away his position like that. Ten Fingers says, "This is a place of worship, no place for demons, no place for devils. Leave or you will regret it." And Daredevil says, "I don't care about your church right now. What I do care about is that. I recognize that energy. I've spent half my life fighting the people that use it. So anyone that you've shared that with is now in just as much danger as you, because you stole that power and the people you took it from will want it back." And at that moment, two of the hench people are shot with arrows. And as Daredevil turns around, we see quite a few. I don't even know how many. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, about 15 ninjas saying, "We are the hand and we will take back what was stolen." And that's where the issue ends. So the art from Ron Garney is strong. The color work is also strong. There's a lot of pages with little color, just two or three different shades, either red or green or blue or pink, based on what the setting is on that particular scene. So, the color work really, really stands out on this book from Matt Milla. And it's a very visceral, kind of dirty street style from Garney, which suits the story that Charles Soule is telling really, really well. So, and I also love that the hand show up really early, right? When it's Daredevil and you're telling stories, street level, ninja, martial arts, the hand cannot be too far behind. So really, really digging it. And again, I do recommend the first volume of Daredevil. Haven't read past the first volume, I think, or maybe it's the second arc that I fell off the book. But anyway, we'll get there. As I said before, I'll be covering one issue of Charles Soule's Daredevil a week for the foreseeable future on Marvel Mondays. All right. Well, once again, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.